Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ambassador Mark Ginsburg, who is a former presidential advisor and United States ambassador to Morocco. He serves as a legislative assistant to Senator Edward Kennedy, special assistant to the Secretary of State, deputy senior advisor to the President for Middle East Policy, and special U.S. coordinator for Mediterranean Trade, Investment, and Security Affairs. He serves as a special advisor to the Department of Defense Special Operations Command and an advisor to the United States Department of State on outreach initiatives to the Muslim world. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Ginsburg.
Thank you to have me again.
And I know last time we spoke, you were very concerned that the United States was sitting on its hands vis-a-vis Assad's brutality in Syria. And there have been some movements on that. But how do you think recent events in Libya are impacting the situation in Syria?
Well, it's hard to tell. I think it. I think we have to see how the last chapter of this revolution in Libya plays out. Clearly, the Syrian people have had to endure their own share of pain and suffering the way the Libyan people have had to endure for the last 6 months. We really have no idea what the costs have been in either country yet. That has yet to be tallied. I suspect that many Syrians are looking at this and saying, well, if we only had the arms, we could take on the regime. The difference, of course, between Libya and Syria is that the Libyans were given and granted weapons by NATO and by other Arab League states, and at the same time, the Syrian people are defenseless and fighting with words.
So one of the things that I see in common here is, and it's interesting to see that it's in some quarters on the left, there's criticism, of course, of NATO, no sense of that the Libyan people freed themselves from a 42-year dictatorship of a kleptocrat who murdered people and stole the country blind. I mean, interesting enough, in the east of Tripoli, it's a working-class neighborhood, industrial area. Everybody supports the rebels. In the west part, which is the affluent area, all of, Gaddafi's cronies, of course, support him. And it seems to be a similar situation in Syria, in as much as that in the poorer areas, the revolution began in Deraa on the border there, a very poor town. The suburbs of Damascus that oppose us, the Assads, are all very working class. And the parts of Damascus that support the Assads are the cronies. So do you see this kind of paradox, that this is a sort of working class revolt against kleptocrats, but yet, it's not getting support from the international left.
Well, I understand exactly what you say. I mean, and you have it quite right. I mean, the people who are the crony kleptocrats around Gaddafi enrich themselves to an incredible degree. And, of course, the Assad family was in Assad Family Inc. They rewarded the people who were loyal to them, particularly the mercantile class in Damascus and in Aleppo, the two major cities. And as a result, there's been not only a decision by these classes, these business classes, not to support the revolutions, but they've also more or less realized that when the revolution succeed, they're the ones who are going to be losing out big time.
So what explains this confusion? Is it just that we, are pretty, we have this kind of romantic idea about revolutionaries? And because I always try to make an effort to talk to the real people in countries, talk to Libyans about Libya, Syrians about Syria. And I'm just wondering what explains the this constant refrain here that NATO is all imperialism, it's the bombing of NATO, and nobody's focusing on the idea that these people freed themselves so much as the West is going in on some neo-imperialist adventure.
Well, look, there's no doubt that without NATO's military support, the rebels would have been defeated by the Gaddafi military. That's a given. I don't think anyone would dispute that who knows what happened on the ground. That being said, it was Libyan blood that was shed on the ground. These were young people who rose up and who were left more or less without a lot of support. Remember, this war was not going in their favor until the last few weeks. And in Syria, NATO is not involved. Obviously, these people are, the people in Syria are courageous and brave, standing up to the brute repression and murder squads of the Iranian-Syrian militias that are there firing on them. The fact of the matter is that the key test will be whether or not the Libyan people are grateful to do, let's not put NATO in the context. This is the United States. This is Britain and France. Will they be grateful to this military support that they received to, that enabled them to get rid of this 42-year-old dictatorship? And that'll be the test, because in the rest of the Arab world, neither NATO, the United States, Great Britain, or France are given a lot of credit for any of the revolutions that have occurred.
But surely there's a tremendous residual suspicion of the West and an anti-colonial history here that you'd have to be sensitive about. It seems to me that the last thing that NATO and the United States should do is start, putting any kind of footprint on the ground in Libya.
Well, obviously, and this is going to be the ironic paradox. Can the Transitional National Council in Libya find the wherewithal and get unified support from the tribal leaders and other elements of the society in the country, particularly the western part of the country, to help stabilize Tripoli and prevent the type of lawlessness, looting, and breakdown of law and order that we saw in Baghdad after Saddam toppled? And if they cannot control this, then it's clear that there'll be other elements who will fill the vacuum, and this is obviously not to our benefit. Will NATO put troops on the ground? I doubt it. Will there be some other, perhaps, effort to try to stabilize the situation by providing logistical support and transforming this ragtag army into a police force? Well, that's going to take time. It took time. It takes time, in whether it was in Kosovo or Bosnia or anywhere else.
Again, I'm speaking with Ambassador Mark Ginsberg, a former presidential advisor and United States ambassador to Morocco. What do you make, though, of this division in the sense of the effectiveness of the Western rebels and, in part, the Berbers, and the fact that the East has been where the Transitional Council have been getting all the support, international support, for the longest time, but they made very little military progress, and it seems to be the Western rebels are the ones that took Tripoli at lightning speed. Do you think there's a possible fault line there between the Eastern and the Western rebels?
You took the phrase right out of my mouth. There is a fault line between East and West. There's residual unhappiness and potential recrimination on the part of the Western rebels and tribal leaders in the western part of the country who stood up to Gaddafi and felt that they did not get the support they deserved from the Transitional National Council. It'll remain to be seen whether or not that injury can be repaired by the TNC.
And I don't mean to move around all the region so much, but just back to Syria, there's some interesting developments, Ambassador Ginsberg, going on with Hamas, for example. Hamas is breaking with Damascus. Apparently, it's freaking out Tehran. And that the attack on the Israeli bus on the Egyptian border was engineered by a Iranian proxy group, and obviously the Iranians are trying to do whatever they can to change the subject here to get people back on thinking about the Israeli-Palestinian issue and not the brutality of the Assads. What's your understanding of these shifting alliances?
Well, look, let's be clear. Assad is completely 100% dependent on Tehran's logistical, financial, and military support to stay in power, without which it's the equivalent of NATO that has come to his rescue. It's the Iranian version of NATO that is providing him the military means to accomplish his objectives. And Hamas, which never had any particular allegiance to Damascus, even though there were elements that were based there, is almost a wholly owned and bought and paid for by Tehran. So it is quite clear that the Iranians are particularly interested, on the one hand, of supporting Damascus. On the other hand, it is unclear, given the vicissitudes of the Muslim Brotherhood's relationship with Hamas in Egypt, how the Hamas is able to play this, because on the one hand, they're dependent on Iran. On the other hand, they're beholden to the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt.
Well, and it doesn't help, surely, if Assad is sending his navy to shoot up Palestinian refugee camps in Latakia.
Yeah, where is all the outcry in the Arab world to the fact that the Syrians targeted a Palestinian refugee camp in Latakia, and in effect it was an assault of deadly dimensions on these Palestinian refugees. Why was that undertaken by the Syrians? Well, this only goes to show you the brazen indifference that the Syrians have had towards the Palestinians that live within their own country. By the way, it's a further evidence that the Assad regime considers the Palestinians living inside Syria as a fifth column to the Assad regime.
Well, I would think, though, that this is going to, surely this is going to have repercussions in Lebanon and in the Palestinian territories.
Well, look, this is such a complicated stew. It's going to be hard to unravel it. Even those of us who follow this are having a hard time trying to decipher what is the game plan that's going on here that would bring such brute force against the Palestinians by the Syrians and Iranians.
So what do you think is Israel's position here? Because Israel and the United States have been fairly ambivalent. You know, one of the things that puzzles me is, you know, the old expression, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Well, if Tehran, the IRGC regime, is our enemy, and they're propping up Assad, why aren't we doing everything we can to cut the legs out from under him, and the Israelis too? So,
well, that's a $64,000 question. It's clear that the controversy over NATO's involvement in Libya more or less cut the ground out from any appetite by the United States or the West to involve themselves in Syria. There's all sorts of diplomatic platitudes that are tossed around. We can't involve ourselves. The United States cannot influence events. This is really up to Turkey and the Syrian people. The Turks are playing their own game here. They obviously have invested an enormous amount with the Assad regime. In the end, they're still praying and pleading with Assad to reform so that they don't lose their investment and lose their ability to influence Iran and Syria, because that's part of their own foreign policy dimensions in that part of the world. It is not consistent with U.S. objectives. So there's a lot of underlying maneuvering and diplomatic shady games going on here.
But and I guess that you have to add to that the dimension of Iraq right next door, because Maliki, of course, is pretty much, I mean, my interpretation of George W. Bush's Iraq war was that Iran won it. And that Maliki is obviously on the Iranian side, but surely what's left of the Sunni opposition there in Anbar, isn't it inevitable that they would form some kind of an alliance and even perhaps supply arms to the Brotherhood next door in Syria?
Well, I think the Brotherhood has largely been decimated in Syria. Number one, number two. There's no doubt that Maliki has basically decided to become a more of a puppet of the Iranian government when it comes to Syria, breaking more or less with his other Arab brethren in the Arab League, largely because he's beholden to Iran as well. And so you have that other dimension. I don't know. It's right now, without arms coming to the Syrian people to be able to stand up to the military might of the regime, there's no doubt that this is going to be an extraordinarily painful war of attrition by the Syrian opposition against this regime.
And do you think that that these belated moves on the part of the Western powers to start isolating the Assad's economically, the sanctions, the export of oil, import of refined products, is that going to affect the elite?
Yeah, there's no doubt. That is really the Achilles heel of this government, of the Assad government. They get about $15 million a day in revenue from oil exports. You choke that off, then all bets are off. But you know what? Neither the British nor the Germans nor the Turks have signaled that they're willing to abide by this international call by the United States to impose sanctions on Syrian oil exports. So this may be more a theoretical exercise in futility than an actual punishment on the Syrian regime. It remains to be seen.
Well, but what explains that? I mean, we're not talking about a lot of money here, so I don't understand that duplicity.
Well, you know what? Please ask the British Prime Minister why he came up with the alibi that he doesn't want to restrict the import of oil from Syria because it would make, quote, harm the Syrian people, unquote.
I see. So you're not, obviously, Ambassador Ginsburg, you don't think a lot's going to happen on that front. Is this going to be a long and painful process involving the spilling of blood on the part of these brave Syrians?
Yes, I'm afraid that the tipping point has been reached. Most of the cities in Syria are now under lockdown. Aleppo and Damascus did not revolt, and the military stayed more or less cohesive with the Assad regime, and I think that portends doom and gloom for these brave, courageous Syrian revolutionaries.
So would that then mean that Iranians have been successful in shoring up that regime?
Yes.
So it's a victory for Tehran?
For the time being. We'll see what happens.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Ambassador Mark Ginsburg.
Thank you.
Again, I mean, speaking with Ambassador Mark Ginsburg, who's a former presidential advisor and United States ambassador to Morocco. He serves as a legislative assistant to Senator Edward Kennedy, special assistant to the Secretary of State, deputy senior advisor to the president for Middle East policy, and special U.S. coordinator for Mediterranean trade, investment, and security affairs. He serves as a special advisor to the Department of Defense Special Operations Command and an advisor to the United States Department of State on outreach initiatives to the Muslim world. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.